Wednesday night. And as chapter 14 came to a close, we saw that David and his estranged son Absalom were reunited after 5 years. Absalom had spent 3 years in Geshur with his family, his mother's side of the family, after he had had his brother Amnon murdered because of what he did to his sister Tamar. And then he had come back to Jerusalem, and he had lived in Jerusalem for 2 full years without seeing the face of the king. So it was after 5 years of being separated that David and Absalom are reunited. But as we come to chapter 15, we're going to begin studying about the rebellion of Absalom and his attempt to steal the throne from David. And as I'll mention later on, this really is more reaping for what David did with Bathsheba and Uriah. The Lord told David that because of what he did, he would raise up evil from within his own house, within his own family. And Absalom is the fulfillment of what God said would happen. Absalom, his own son, his own flesh and blood, rises against David and seeks to steal the throne. And this is something that's going to play itself out over the next several chapters. But it begins here in chapter 15. And this is a story of deception. It's a story of lies. It's a story of defection, where you'll have people that will turn away from David and give their allegiance to Absalom. But at the same time, within this story, you find great loyalty. You'll see many of David's friends and servants that were loyal, that stayed with him through thick and thin. You'll see also that this is a story of courage. People will hazard their lives for David's sake to do things for him. So there's a lot of negative, but there's also some positive that we'll see as we go through this story together. But again, the story begins here in chapter 15 with Absalom doing what he needed to steal the hearts, as the Bible says, of the men of Israel. And really, in order to be successful in a rebellion or any endeavor, you have to have the favor and the support of the people. There's no question about that. So Absalom understood that if he was ever to be king in the place of his father, he would have to get the loyalty of the people, or at least the majority of the people. So he begins that process here as we start this 15th chapter. Notice it says in verse number 1, and it came to pass after this, and the after this would be what we studied about in the previous chapter. And it doesn't tell us here how much time has lapsed from what we studied in chapter 14 to what we're studying in chapter 15, but some time has gone by. And after what we read there, after that in the previous chapter, it came to pass that Absalom prepared him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. So he's been gone for 3 years. He's been back for 2 years, but obviously in his estrangement, he has already been contemplating his plan, already been thinking about trying to take over the throne. And if we are to believe what God said was going to happen, we have to understand to a certain extent that either the Lord put this in Absalom's heart, or God just allowed what wickedness was already in his heart to transpire and take place and not stop it. You kind of have to look at it one of the other ways in that, because God did say, right? He did say that he would have evil to rise against David from his own house. So either the Lord put this in Absalom's heart, or again, God just let the wickedness and the rebellion that was already in his heart go unchecked. Either way. But this is what's going on here. He's been thinking about this, and now he tries to put it into play. And the first thing he does is he prepares him chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. This is to try to show himself to be an important individual, obviously, because he's got his chariot that he's going to be in. Then he's got other chariots around him with people that are like his bodyguards and his protectors and people that are on his side. He's got 50 men to run before him. It's a show of power, a show of authority. It's to try to show that he's some person of importance. It's to garner attention from other people, because obviously people are going to take notice. If Absalom's just walking down the street, there'd be people that would notice Absalom because he's the king's son. But they're going to notice him a lot more if he comes down the street in a chariot with other chariots around him and 50 men running out in front of him. So it's to garner attention from the people, to get the people to focus more on him, thinking that he's somebody important, that type of thing. And notice in verse number 2 it says, "And Absalom rose up early and stood beside the way of the gate." That's probably going to be the main gate, the gate used most often by the people to enter into the city of Jerusalem. Remember, that's where they're at. They're in Jerusalem. And he gets up early and he goes out and he stands there beside the way of the gate. And this is not something he did just one time, but he did it several times. But he went there for a purpose. It says, "And it was so that when any man had a controversy, came to the king for judgment, then Absalom called unto him and said, Of what city art thou? And he said, Thy servant is one of the tribes of Israel." So he'd go out there to where the gate's at, where people be coming and going. And any time a person came with a controversy, and not necessarily a controversy against the king, but a controversy they had with another person, something going on between them and another person, and they're coming to the king for judgment, it says there in the verse. In other words, they wanted David to decide what needed to be done between them and whoever their controversy was with. And that's kind of the way it was. If you remember the previous chapter, when Joab got that woman to go talk to the king, she comes there with that story that she tells him, and that's one reason why David didn't find that strange in the beginning, is because that's the natural way. That's how it was. People would come to the king whenever they had something going on to try to get his judgment on the situation. And so whenever a person would come there for that purpose, then Absalom would be there waiting, and he'd call out to him and he'd say, "Of what city art there? Where are you coming from? Where's your city that you're coming from, or what city are you coming from?" And whenever they would respond, they'd say, "Thy servant is one of the tribes of Israel." And that was important to him, because his main goal was to win the hearts of the people of Israel. He wanted their hearts more than any other, because without their loyalty and their support, there's no possible way that he could pull off his plan of becoming king in the stead of his father. So he's going to focus on those people especially that say they are from the tribes of Israel. And in verse number 3, notice, and I want to show you, you look at verse 3, 4, and 5, and you see how it was that Absalom stole the hearts of the people. And folks, what you read in those three verses is just like how politicians do it today. I'm telling you, you just read it, you follow along here, you'll see it. I'm telling you, it's clear as crystal. It is exactly how politicians do it right now. Notice verse number 3. The first thing that he does in verse number 3 is try to discredit his opponent. His opponent, obviously, is his father, David. Now, David doesn't understand at this point that Absalom's against him, but Absalom was wanting to take the throne from his father. And he knows, first off, I got to discredit him. I got to get it to where the people are thinking bad of my daddy. They've got to get to the point where they're not satisfied with his leadership. And if I can get them to be unsatisfied with his leadership, then I can direct them toward me and I can be king. Look at what he does here in verse 3. "And Absalom said unto him," that would be somebody that came with a controversy, "Absalom said unto him, See, thy matters are good and right." He's going to butter him up, first of all. "Your matters are good and right." Like, you got a legitimate case or a legitimate cause. it's good, it's the right situation here. He wouldn't say you're wrong. He'd say they're good and right. Most politicians are going to, and we're going to talk more about this when we get down to verse number 5, they're going to try to butter up the people. That's why they start making all kind of promises and saying things that they know people want to hear, right? And the truth of the matter is, and anybody with any good walking around sense knows that about 99% of every promise that any politician from any group has ever made, that man that says that knows when he says it, there's a high probability he'll never be able to do what he says he's going to do. He realizes that. But if he came in with that, if his approach was, there's not much I'm going to be able to do for you, he knows he's not going to get elected to office. He's got to make promises. He's got to butter up the people, got to get them thinking that he's the right man for the job and he can do so much more than the leadership that's in place at the time. So Absalom says, thy matters are good and right. But here's how he tries to discredit the king. But there is no man deputed of the king to hear thee. Deputed is a word that means to appoint a substitute or a representative to act for another. He says, look, you got a legitimate case. It's good and right. The problem is the king doesn't have anybody out here for you. And maybe it was true, but you know why David didn't have anybody out there at the time? Because he did that himself. David didn't need another man at this point. That's what we just talked about. Verse number 2, notice. When any man had a controversy, came to the king for judgment. The way it was at the time is when somebody needed judgment, they came to David. There was no point for him at this point in the situation to have somebody out there. He did it himself. He took care of it himself. But what he's trying to do, what Absalom's trying to do, is discredit David. Get the people thinking, well, yeah, you know, David ought to have somebody out here. He's shirking his responsibility. He's not doing what he should. He's not being a good king in this because we have our controversies and we have our problems and things we need to get settled. He ought to have somebody out here. See how he gets the wheels to turning in people's head, thinking negative of David, like he's not doing what he ought to do? That's the very first thing he does here, is he discredits his opponent. And isn't that what they do? You ever listen to I'm not even talking about Republicans versus Democrats. That's an obvious. They constantly bickering back and forth and fighting and saying who's right and who's wrong and all that. But have you ever seen how they do it within their own party? You ever seen a Republican or a Democratic debate? You ever wasted your time and watched one of those? That's about what it is nowadays, just a monumental waste of time. I don't even hardly watch them anymore because it's just a waste. But even like, just say you have a Republican debate. Each one of them up there, you know what every one of them does when it gets their time to talk? They discredit the other ones up there. They try to make themselves out to be, you know, so much better than the others. And they bring up all this stuff. They sling mud against all these other people that are within their own party. But that's the thing they do, is they try to discredit their opponent. That's what he does. And then the second thing is in verse number 4. Not only does he discredit his opponent, but then he builds himself. And that's the second thing they do. They put down the others and they build yourself up. That's how you get elected. You put down the people around you, make them look bad, you make yourself look good. That's how you do it. And this, by the way, applies to a whole lot of things in life, not just to politics. This kind of mess right here goes on all the time. It goes on even within churches. It goes on within businesses. All kind of things, you know. But look at verse 4. Absalom said, moreover, that is, in addition to what he already said, this is something else he says. Oh, that I were made judge in the land. You see that? Oh, that I were made judge in the land. That every man, see the wording, every man, that's promises, big promises, that you can't ever keep. They all do it. They make those big promises. They know they can't keep them when they make them. But I tell you, sometimes the people that I blame the most are not the politicians that do all this. It's us people here in America that are so dumb we listen to all that junk. I get aggravated at us sometimes that after all these years we haven't realized what a bunch of scoundrels most all of them are. and how they're just lying, most of them just lying through their teeth because they want the position. And they know what they got to do to get that position. But he says, oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man which hath any suit, like a lawsuit, or cause might come unto me, and I would do him justice. I'd do what my daddy ain't doing. See how he discredited David? And then he starts building himself up, pumping himself up. He's getting them dissatisfied with the leadership that's in place. He's not doing his job. We need a change. We need something different. And hey, I'm the man for the job. And they always believe they are. They always believe they're the person that needs to step in and that they'll do it. And that's what he does second, is he builds up himself. Says, I'll do what the king's not doing. I'll provide you the kind of leadership that you need if I were the judge in the land. And that's all of it you hear. When I get in office, I'll do this all the time. Verse 5, here's the third thing. He plays to the people. And it was so that when any man came nigh to him to do him obeisance, that's they come to show him reverence, respect. Oftentimes they would bow down in front of him and that sort of thing. It says, when they came nigh to do him obeisance, he put forth his hand and took him and kissed him. He wouldn't let them do that. He wouldn't let them bow down or anything like that. He wanted them to think that he believed that he was on the same level with them, that he wasn't any better or any more significant or any more important than them. No, don't bow down to me. When they would start to bow down, he'd say, no, don't do that. He'd take them by the hand and pick them up, and then he would kiss them. You see what he's doing? It's like a show of humility on his part, just buttering up the people. I'm not any better than you. I'm just a person like you are. I'm on the same level as you are. I don't think I'm any better than you, that kind of thing. He's just buttering up the people. He did everything that was necessary. I mean, he did it right. Absalom knew what he was doing. And the people today, they've taken a page. That was one point I wanted to make is this stuff that you see going on in the world now, the Bible says there's nothing new under the sun in the book of Ecclesiastes. That business you see going on now in politics and all this other stuff, it's been going on for thousands of years. It's just different people involved, but it's the same strategy still right now as it was thousands of years ago. You discredit your opponent, you build yourself up, you play to the people, and look what happened, verse number 6. And on this manner did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So everyone that came, he did the same thing, and look what happened. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. He accomplished what he wanted. He got their hearts. To steal their hearts means that their hearts were with David, right? And he stole them. It's not that David acted in a bad way and lost the hearts of the people. David just kept doing as he had been doing. Absalom came in and stole the hearts of those people. And this is where his rebellion really gets started. Look at verse number 7. And it came to pass after 40 years. That's probably going to be after 40 years of his life. So Absalom's probably over 40 years at this point. It came to pass after 40 years that Absalom said unto the king, I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. For thy servant vowed a vow while I abode in Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. So he comes to the king and he says, give me permission to go to Hebron. And you want to pay attention to Hebron because that's a fairly significant place with regards to David. Do you remember before David became the king over all of Judah and Israel? Where he was king at? Remember, that's right. Remember, he was king in Hebron before he ever became king over all of the people of Israel. That's where his rule, that's where his reign started. So Absalom's going back to this place, or he says to David, let me go there and pay my vow, which I have vowed. A vow is a promise. Like when you get married, you know, you say your vows, you're making promises to one another. It's a promise. And he says that when I was there in Gesher, he's talking about those 3 years that he was away down there with his mother's family. He says, while I was there, I went to Hebron and I vowed a vow. I made a promise to the Lord, and this was my promise. If the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. In other words, Lord, if you'll get me back to Jerusalem, where I don't have to stay down here anymore, then I'll serve you. Now, I don't believe that he made that promise. He's just saying this to get permission and leave from the king to go down to Hebron to further his rebellion, further his plan, as we'll see in just a moment. One thing I noticed in that verse is something that I have heard people say many times through the years. In talking with the people, I've heard people say something very similar. Actually, make a promise to God. Say something like, well, Lord, if you'll heal my body or you'll get me through this hardship or you'll do whatever it is, then I promise you I'll serve you. I promise you I'll be faithful. I've talked to people many times through the years that have made those promises. I talked to one individual one time who told me that, and I forget now what the situation was, but he was in some kind of bad situation. And I knew the guy real well. In fact, I went to school with him, but he told me that he had got in this really bad situation. He promised the Lord if the Lord would get him through that he'd get in church and he wouldn't ever get out and he'd just serve God the rest of his life, you know, all these big promises. Well, you know what the Lord did? He got him through every bit of it. And the guy did start going to church. But after a while, you know what he did? He just dropped back out of church, quit going to church. Oftentimes when people find themselves in difficult situations, they'll make promises to the Lord. It's an emotional time, and they're just looking for some help and looking for a way out, and really what they're doing, if you just want to boil it down, is they're trying to barter a deal with God. They're saying, Lord, if you do this for me, then this is what I'll do for you. The implication, you understand, in such a promise is, God, if you don't do this for me, then I'm not going to serve you. That's the implication. If your promise is, Lord, if you will do this for me, then I'll serve you, then what you're saying, in effect, is, God, if you don't do this, then I'm not going to serve you. And I'm going to just tell you right now, that's a sorry way to approach your relationship with the Lord. That's a sorry way to approach your relationship with the Lord. Because here's the truth. The truth is, you ought to serve him whether he never does anything else for you the rest of your life. He's already done way more for you now than you deserve, hadn't he? I mean, we didn't deserve him to do anything for us. But he's already done so much for us. My perspective on life as a Christian should be, Lord, you've been so good to me, so merciful to me, so wonderful to me so many times. I didn't deserve any of it. And if you'll just help me, I'm going to serve you the rest of my life. I'm just going to be faithful and be thankful for what you've already done in my life. Not the perspective, if you don't do this for me. Because basically what you're doing then is you're saying, you know, I know you've done all this other stuff, but I don't care about that anymore. If you want my faithfulness from this point forward, you'll do this for me right now. It's trying to barter some kind of deal with God. That's not the way you approach your relationship with the Lord. But a lot of people do it that way. If the Lord will get me through this, if he'll spare me, then I'll serve him. Well, let me ask you this morning. And I've asked you this question in days gone by, but let me ask you again this morning. If you knew right now, if you knew, if there was some way you could know right now that God was not going to ever do another thing for you the rest of your life on this earth, would you still serve him? Would you? Would you still be faithful? Or would you get sour and bitter and put out and quit serving God right now? That's something to think about. Now, the likelihood of you continuing to live and God not doing something for you is like slim to none, because he's just that good of a God. Amen. But just, you know, hypothetically, if you knew he wasn't going to do anything else for you, If your perspective is that you would stop serving him, then that shows that the only reason you serve him right now is because of his handouts in your life. Just because of what he does for you. If your service and faithfulness is dependent upon what God does for you and continues to do for you, then you just like people are with the government. It's just all about the handout with you and what God will do for me and what he'll give me. That doesn't need to be my perspective at all. I should serve him whether he does anything else for me the rest of my life. Just because of who he is. He's God. Just be faithful to him. What would you do? Would you keep on going to church? Would you keep on praying? Would you keep on reading your Bible? So many times people drop out. They quit when they don't think God's doing things the way that he ought to do them in their life. Yes, ma'am. That's exactly right. That's right. Yeah, it really wouldn't be an option, would it? Because you'd be dead. But anyway, that's what Absalom says. If the Lord shall bring me again indeed to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. It's almost, which again, I don't think he said this, but it's almost as if he's confessing that he wasn't serving him then. You see that? If you'll get me back to Jerusalem, then I'll serve you. Well, what was he doing then? He must not have been serving him then. If the requirements get me there, then I'll serve you. Then obviously at the time he wasn't serving the Lord, which again, I don't think it was a legitimate thing he said here. He's just trying to get to Hebron to further his cause. Look at verse 9. And the king said unto him, go in peace. So he arose and went to Hebron. But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, then you shall say, Absalom reigneth in Hebron. So he sent these spies through all these different tribes, and he sends them there for a purpose. He wants those spies to help further his cause. Whenever they hear a trumpet, it obviously was a specific trumpet that he had in place for this situation, then those spies were to cry out amongst all the people, Absalom reigneth in Hebron. See that? He's putting these spies in place to do this, to get the people to thinking that Absalom is now reigning and in control. You see in verse 11, he gets him some more people to go along with him. And with Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that were called. And notice this, they went in their simplicity and they knew not anything. In other words, they didn't go with Absalom. These 200 didn't go because they wanted to be rebellious. Absalom had them called. They went in their simplicity. They just figured there was a reason to go with Absalom. But they didn't have any idea what Absalom was trying to do here. They just kind of got sucked into the situation. And sometimes that happens in life. Sometimes you get sucked into things, you don't even know what's going on. You don't know the whole story. You're completely innocent in it. You're just trying to go along to be a friend or whatever. And you wake up and find yourself in the middle of a bad situation. Verse 12 says, and Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city, even from Gilo, which, while he offered sacrifices, and the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom. Now Absalom's reaching out to specific members of David's cabinet, you might say. He reaches out here to Ahithophel, that was David's counselor. So he's starting to get in real close and call people that are close companions with David. And you see at the end of the verse there that his conspiracy is strong, and as time passes, the people continually increase with Absalom. So it's just getting bigger and bigger. It's kind of snowballing as time goes on. And all this stuff's going on, and guess who doesn't have a clue? David's clueless at this point. What's that? Yeah, that's right. That's right. But verse 13, you see that he does find out here. And there came a messenger to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom. Doesn't say who the messenger was, but somebody comes and they finally give word to David. Probably was a shock to some extent, because this is his son, okay, his own flesh and blood. And it's a shock because at this point he didn't realize what was happening. But I just wonder if when he got this message, David's mind went back to that promise that God made him of what was going to happen. It doesn't say that, but you just have to wonder, because the Lord had already spoke to David, already told him what was going to happen. You have to think that maybe his mind went back there and thought, all right, here it is. God's confirming his word. He's doing exactly what he said he was going to do. He's allowing this to happen because it's his own son. That would be from within his house. I can't think of many betrayals that would be worse than your own flesh and blood. That's about as bad as it gets, isn't it? You know, a child, a spouse, something like that, stabbing you in the back, doing something horrible. That's on this earth down here, as far as betrayal goes, that's about as bad as it gets right there, when it's your own flesh and blood that turns against you. And that's what happens here with David. It's his own flesh and blood, which I think is one reason why God did that. Because God intended, don't make any mistake about it, God intended to be very severe with David because of what he did. What David did was a horrible thing, a atrocious, horrible thing in committing adultery and then having that woman's husband killed. That was a terrible thing. And even though God spared David's life and forgave him, God wasn't fixing to sweep that under the rug and act like it never happened. He intended for David to suffer for the terrible thing that he did. And some of the things that God brought about in David's life was, like I say, some of that stuff's about as bad as you can get down here. Raising up, it would have been bad, what I'm trying to say, it would have been bad with anybody that God raised against David. But wouldn't you agree that it's worse that it was his son that came against him? It'd be bad if it had, you know, been Joab or somebody that wasn't related to him. But the fact that he raised up his own son against him just makes it about as bad as you can possibly get down here. And that's what happens. Verse 14, and we're going to stop right here. And David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for we shall not else escape from Absalom. Make speed to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring evil upon us and smite the city with the edge of the sword. David immediately gathers his servants, and he says, we got to leave. We got to get out of here, or Absalom's going to get us, and then he's going to come in. He's going to kill everybody in the whole city. We got to go. Got to go. And right here, it's where David gets on the run again. And it's like I said before, he went through all that stuff with Saul, all those years on the run, all that time living out there in the wilderness, going from one cave to the other, one hideout to the other, just trying to make it. And all those people that were with him having to suffer along beside of him. God brought him through every bit of that, and he was at peace. We saw where he was given rest from all of his enemies. The Bible said he's able to stay there in Jerusalem, have his own house to live in with his servants and his family close by. Everything's good. And now where is he at again? He's on the run, living out in the wilderness again. And you know what brought all that on? His sin. Himself. I just wonder how many nights when he laid down, David cried himself to sleep thinking, what a fool. Look what I've done to myself. Look what I've done to my family. There's his family in a house, living there safe, everything good. And now he's having to pull his family out of all of that comfort and all that peace and all that rest and drag them back out on the run again and live away, endanger their lives. And every bit of that was caused by him. He did it. David couldn't even blame the devil. You know who he could blame? Himself. And I'm telling you, I look back at my life and the things that I've been through, hardships, some of the hardships I've been through, I can't even blame the devil for it. This old boy right here, being a knothead, doing things I didn't need to do. That's how it is with a lot of folks. A lot of people right now, their family's suffering, their spouse is suffering, their kids suffering, their whole life suffering. People around them miserable and going through terrible times because they gave into their flesh and did something in a moment of time just to make themselves happy. And now they're suffering and everybody around them suffering. Any questions about what we looked at here today? Yes, sir. That's right. Absolutely. All right, let's take a break. Yes, ma'am. Okay.